Colts Hidden Killers Investigates. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A guy in a small Maine town says God spoke to him at a pond. That's the origin story. From that, he builds a network of churches, schools, and missions in over 70 countries. Greater Grace World Outreach ran for decades without most people ever hearing about it. Still does. Then in late 2025, a 172-page independent investigation blew the doors off. And what's inside that document says it's bad. Alleged abuse spanning decades, leadership that allegedly looked the other way, a system designed to keep people quiet, allegedly. But before we get into what happened, we need to understand what this place actually is. Alita Galvin was raised inside Greater Grace from the time she was 4 months old, born into the original location in southern Maine where it all started. She hosts the podcast Looking for Grace and has spent years investigating this organization. Our other guest today, you're not going to see on camera if you are watching us, but if you're listening to us, you will hear him. So you won't really notice anything different there, but he's not going to be on camera, just so you know. Our other guest, he's going by the name Oscar. He walked into Greater Grace as an adult, spent years inside, left in 2004, and still lives with the trauma. He's using that pseudonym because even 20 years later, this stuff follows you. One was born into it, one shows it. Both got consumed by it. Welcome you guys to the program. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories here. I want to preface before we get into everything, these are your opinions, these are allegations, and we're going to treat them as such as we have these conversations. Congregations, because we're talking about a church type thing. That's what I go to right away. But Alita, you obviously have a deep, deep, deep dive on this, far, far greater than even what we're going to be doing today on your podcast, Looking for Grace. Alita, I want to start here. You didn't pick this. You were born into it, raised at the exact spot where Carl Stevens started the whole thing. From someone who's never heard of Greater Grace, and I don't think a lot of people have, what did your childhood look like? Did you ever sense something was wrong with this, or was this just the only world that you knew?
So this was the only world that I knew. I was actually born in Massachusetts at their second location, and then my parents moved to Maine when I was 4 months old, where I grew up. And to be honest, outside of what was going on at our home, which with my dad was not great most of the time, my childhood was actually pretty great. We lived at the church property, which was situated in the downtown area of a small New England town. It had formerly belonged to the Catholic Church and had housed the nuns in the chapel for the church. So every now and again, I like to joke that I grew up in a convent, which is sort of true. Our apartment was actually in the portion of the building that had housed the nuns. The property itself, though, was huge. There were lots of families, which meant there were a lot of other kids to play with. We had places to ride our bikes, roller skate, swing, and just run around and play and be kids. Mm-hmm. I even went to public school the first few years of elementary school and then again in high school. And in the middle, I attended a Christian school that rented space at the church property, but wasn't affiliated or run by Greater Grace, just happened to be renting the space. But I will say there was one time as a kid that I remember recognizing that I was different or that I was missing out on something. One of my friends at school had brought in an ET doll to school for show and tell. And all my other classmates were super excited, but I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. And because my classmates' initials were ET, I thought she had named the doll after herself. And everybody looked at me funny when I asked. But outside of that, it really wasn't until a lot later, especially when I returned to public high school my senior year, that I really started to notice the difference between my world and everybody else's world.
I mean, it sounds like that's a world, on the surface, an easy way to saying it is being sheltered from the outside. But I mean, I think it goes a lot deeper than that. And it's similar because we hear a lot of the same things from folks from the Duggar clan, where it's years of childhood that actually are not bad. It's out playing outside. It's being a kid. It's being an old school kid to a certain extent. But at the same point, that's wonderful, But then you also, you kind of miss out on what's going on with society around you. Sheltered is one thing. How would you describe it?
Sheltered is a good word for it. I mean, for a long time, I really didn't know what I was missing out on. I really had no way of knowing.
Yeah. Sheltered. Oscar is with us too. Like I said, you're not going to see him on screen, but you'll hear his voice. Oscar, you walked in, and this is different. You walked in as an adult, whereas Alita was pretty much, you know, kind of born into this, this life. You had your own life, your own mind. Oscar, take us there. What did the early days feel like to you? And when did you first realize the version of this place they showed you really wasn't the real one? Give us an idea of where you were at in life and what brought you in there, and then let's walk into that.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Thanks for having me on. I'll try to be as brief with this as sure. I can be. I had a long history in Christianity going back to my childhood in the Lutheran church. I had gotten more fervent about my faith during later high school and college, and sort of matriculated into more of a Baptist Pentecostal, you know, flow and church life on my own. Went to college, you know, graduated into computing, had a very, very fabulous early career in tech, and got married to a woman I had met in church. That marriage, unfortunately, did not work out. Thankfully, we did not have any children. And I will be honest, trying to function as a divorced person, especially a divorced man who initiated the divorce to save his own sanity, in the evangelical culture is not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal of sort of condemnation you have to swim through. So after my divorce, for about 4 years, I didn't go to church at all. I called them my Renaissance years, from 1990 to 1994. So I investigated a lot of different philosophical ideas and had liberal girlfriends and, kind of embraced all that for a while. And then I came back to my faith, largely due to an old friend, a female who I was secretly in love with, who had never been married. That relationship didn't work out, and a lot of it was around my divorce and, you know, the evangelical culture and teachings around that. So when I initially met Greater Grace, at Alita's church, I attended there with another friend while I was in New England on a business trip. I saw something different. I sensed this grace message, this love that went so far beyond, you know, the legalism that I had experienced around the divorce issue, that I thought, wow, you know, this could be a fresh start for me. And over the following months, I was able, because I worked for a very progressive company that deeply valued me, and I had a long history with them. They had just crossed the $1 billion revenue mark, and I'd kind of been part of developing a lot of the core software that made that work. So they wanted to keep me, you know, along with a lot of other people. I'm not saying I was that special, but they wanted to retain me. And this was the mid-90s. And boy, you just couldn't find, you know, people with the kind of experience I had. It was very difficult. So they allowed me to move to New England and work in Boston. They had an office there, and then ultimately from home up across the line in New Hampshire, close to where the church was in Maine. And so I moved up there and became part of that little church, which was affiliated with Baltimore, with the headquarters where Carl H. Stevens preached. And I made trips down to Baltimore, and eventually after a year, I moved down there. There were more people my age, and it was just a faster pace. You know, even though I had this intense career, so I had to balance those two things. As far as what began to, the red flags for me was just the level of commitment that was kind of expected. You know, if you really embraced the message and had the vision for what the church was all about, which was, you know, world missions and heavy evangelism, discipleship, commitment to really internalizing this message that Stevens had, you know, developed over many decades. And I'll admit, it was an impressive message. I mean, he knew the Bible so well, and he could articulate so many points of view around psychology and human behavior, human sexuality, all of those things. And as for a thinking person like me, I was very drawn to it initially. As far as, you know, the red flags, I can remember, and this was after I'd moved to Baltimore, met the wonderful woman who is now, sorry, my wife of 29 years. She had been a lifelong single woman, missionary in Greater Grace. And she's still, you know, married me and loves and has loved me for 3 decades almost now. So anyway, we're living in Baltimore, and I'm, you know, working 50 hours a week from home, and she was on the church staff in the missions office. And I don't remember the particular topic, but Stevens preached one of his just hardcore barn-burning messages where he used a lot of his famous oratorical vocal inflections and for a sensitive person like me, a thinking person, I realized that, my God, I'm being manipulated. My mind, my heart is being manipulated by this man's rhetoric. And yes, he does have a powerful understanding of Scripture. And yes, he has created all these definitions, and there is a wonderful side of it, but there is this other shoe that dropped. Mm-hmm. So I had to sit with that for a while. I didn't say anything to my wife. And about a week later, and this was unusual, they had a prayer service, a prayer line after Stevens's message and the closing everything. And I went up, and there was there's a lot of pastors in Baltimore because he has a big staff, and we'll get to that later. But I confessed to one of the pastors, I said, I'm having a real hard time with Pastor Stevens' authority. I said, I feel like my heart is really in rebellion. And now I wish I wouldn't have said anything. I wish I would have just sat with it. But my wife comes home 2 or 3 days later, and she says, Pastor approached me at church today in the hall and said, is your husband, is Oscar still with us? You know, and I realized at that point when she shared that with me, yeah, they've got this grapevine going on too. You know, they're kind of figuring out who's with them and who's not. So, mm-hmm.
What, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you made the life choice to move all the way there. You know, something spoke to you, and it sounds like you were intrigued, and you were brought in. This seemed like something was going to be very powerful to you. Yeah. And then you sat with it a little bit longer, and then you saw, okay, maybe this, what was it, a moment of this, maybe I didn't quite see all this? What was the shift, I guess, for you? Were you not able to identify how extreme they may be, or how harsh his rhetoric may be, or his control, as you say it, may be at the beginning, and it took some time to kind of simmer in it, to really feel it? What was the point where you realized, oh, this isn't what I thought it was?
I can't say that there was a single point.
Yeah.
I think my subconscious and unconscious mind was processing some of this, even going back to when I was still up where Alita was before I moved to Baltimore, because Stephen's preaching was broadcast. All the close affiliate churches were listening to his messages and raps, and like the Pastor Brown at the time and up in Maine, he would take Stevens's messages and boil them down, kind of simplify them a little bit, and preach them himself, or preach from them. But trying to answer your question directly, the best way I can say it is I knew what it meant to be wounded by the evangelical culture mm-hmm. around one of the, you know, divorce and remarriage is one of the biggest hot button topics in conservative Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, you've covered Gothard quite a bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go look at his views on
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you'll kind of see how many people have been destroyed over this issue emotionally. So for me, that was always in the back of my mind. It's like, my God, you know, God's grace, what Stevens is preaching must be true, because one of the most amazing women in the entire ministry, this single woman who I'm the only man she's ever loved in her life. She served the ministry until she was almost 40 years old before she made herself, you know, available to God for marriage. And I show up and, you know, we meet each other and
yeah, you're feeling like this is almost like a divine intervention. And
exactly.
And it's kind of the frog in the boiling pot of water to a certain extent.
But let me get to one thing.
Yeah.
I was going to talk about this in one of your later points, but the preemptive damage control. So before I moved up to Southern Maine to the church that Alita's from, that initial year that I spent, I did some discernment. I flew up there two or three times. I flew to Boston and drove up and just spent time with people in the church mm-hmm. and the pastor and his wife. We went out to eat. We talked. And they sat me down. I'll never forget in their living room. They had an apartment in the building where Alita lived. And they looked at me and they said, have you heard of the Martin Report from Christian Research Institute? And I said, no. And they said, that's good, because it's an evil report. And it was done, you know, against the ministry. You know, we're a worldwide evangelizing, soul-winning ministry. And it's an evil report. Please don't read it. You know, now, this is 1995. The internet was in its infancy. You couldn't just do it would have been an Alta Vista search at the time and go find the damn thing online, you know? You were going to have to go do some digging to get your hands on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, other people told me the same thing. So,
yeah, control the information. The investigation here that was recently done into Greater Grace, it talked about Greater Grace having its own language, and it's something that we see in a lot of cults. And that's why I'm interested in, and I'm not calling them a cult. Well, in my opinion, maybe I am, but it's my opinion. When we're talking about different language, we see it in other groups. We see it where transgressions might mean something far lighter than what the actual transgressions were. And insert word here, and it usually is some word that if you take it outside of the context of that organization would have a very different meaning, or the weight of it would be very different. Words and phrases refined by, in this case, the founders' teachings. If you used a wrong term, you apparently heard about it immediately. Can you talk to me about that a little bit? What does it do to your head when the group you're in starts telling you that your vocabulary is wrong, that certain words mean this and not that? Give us some insight into how the word salad bar worked with Greater Grace in your
opinion. Alita, do you want to go first? You've got, I think I mailed you my glossary. You got it right there.
Wow.
I have it.
Oh my God.
I okay. have it. All right. The expanded Alita, version.
Explain away.
Oh man. I mean, oh, hang on. Let me just look up one word.
I mean, is it like speaking in code? What are we talking about?
Some of it, yeah.
I mean, just for someone who's not remotely familiar with this idea that there's different words, you know, you can kind of get it on certain things, but you got a damn glossary. That's a lot of stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just one or two words here. Just explain to me what this is.
So let me just pull out one. Faith rest drills. It's called faith rest drills.
Faith rest drills. So they're like making up terms, basically.
Correct.
Okay.
The specific application of the word acting in the human spirit through theatric action of God's inner government, being tested in trials of faith to see if we respond in quietness and to see what we reveal during this time. I mean, it's wild.
It's like they took a bunch of words and put them together. It's like corporate speak almost, but for religion.
To a
certain extent, where you get like the memo, like the forward-looking memo of a statement.
Oh, believe me, it's much worse than corporate speak. I lived in that world. It's much worse.
Well, I mean, give me some examples of how this stuff was used in practice, Oscar.
Okay. So, yeah, this goes back to before I even moved up to Maine, when I was on one of those weekend sort of discernment trips. Two of the pastors and their wives in the church wanted to have dinner with me. You know, this is kind of all part of the, you know, the sales job, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they lived in the building where Alita lived. So I went to their apartment and, you know, we'd sat down and we were having this nice dinner. And I remember saying, I was trying to be, you know, complimentary. And I said, this is really a wonderful community you have here. Okay. And, mm-hmm. All of a sudden, everybody gets really quiet. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I said? And then one of the pastors says, well, he goes, that's not really a term we refer to ourselves or we like to focus on here. And, you know, I didn't know anything about their culture. So I said, yeah, you may hear that here too soon.
Yeah.
I said, why not? And he said, because it has connotations of familiarity. He said, like he pointed to the other pastor and his wife. He says, they've never been to our apartment. This is their first time. And we don't want to be familiar with each other. You know, we want to only know each other in Christ and as members of the body, you know? And I just kind of sat and, you know, it really befuddled me. And I don't think community is in the glossary, but that just shows you how deep it's like there's this secret knowledge that goes even beyond the things they publish.
Is it used in your opinion in a way to kind of identify who's part of the group where it's like, if you're using our certain language and you're using it correctly to mean the things that we have assigned it to mean, we know you're one of us versus someone who's might be using it, as you did, I guess there incorrectly, it told them you're not quite part of the circle, at least not yet. I don't know
that that's a formal thing. It's like they're having backroom meetings where they
but that's the outcome essentially.
The essential outcome exactly is that the longer you're in, the more mm-hmm. inculcated you get with the speak, the more you're going to speak the way they speak.
Neat, making up their own language. That's fun. Alita, your father was abusive. The church leaders knew it. Again, this is something that we see so many patterns and cycles when it comes to coercively controlled groups or cults where you have the abuse going on, obviously. And instead of calling authorities or getting real help, they decide, you know what, we're going to handle it in-house because it always works so much better when we do it inside because policing ourselves works so well. They shuffled your family between pastors and told you kids to keep quiet and to honor your father. I mean, how old were you before somebody outside that system told you what was actually happening in your home wasn't okay? Give us this story of how they basically normalized the not normal.
So I was 17. I was almost 18. And just for context, my father was a very talented pianist. Mm-hmm. And so he was very well liked, very well known, very well respected, had traveled and played for a lot of people, including Carl Stevens himself back in the day. But he had significant anger issues and they knew it. And all my life, he would get angry over anything. Like, we never knew what it was going to be. And that particular late spring, early summer, he had gotten angry with me over what I don't really remember. He had pinned me against the refrigerator in our apartment, and he was right in my face screaming at me, which at this point in my life, like, him being physical was new. I don't recall before him being physical with me, but him screaming at me was definitely not new. And so I really didn't think a whole lot of it. I was out a few days later with my boyfriend, and we were in his pickup truck riding down the road. It's hot. I've got a t-shirt on. The sleeve moved and he saw a bruise. I didn't realize that my dad had left circular bruises on my upper arms from pinning me against the fridge. And he saw the bruises and was like, "What is that?" And so, of course, I look and I, my dad got mad the other day and, you know, he held me and he was screaming at me. And I said it like it was no big deal, because to me at this point, it wasn't. He pulled the truck over and asked to look at the other arm. And he just looked at me and he said, "That is completely not normal. And it is not okay that he did that to you." And that's the first time anybody had actually said that, that this is not normal behavior. This is not appropriate behavior. And this cannot continue.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize until much later in life, he actually went and confronted my father and told him straight up he would not be doing that again, or he would report him.
So, I mean, how is it being handled internally there?
Oh, they sent them to different pastors, most of whom were not trained to handle this kind of situation. And to be fair, not only did they not give they didn't do my family any favors. They didn't do my dad any favors either. I mean, they let him go unchecked with all these issues for so long. In the end, he lost out on a lot in terms of relationships with us, with his family, because of his issues that just went untreated and unchecked. And he didn't ever feel like he had to. And why should he? They weren't going to do anything about it because they cared more about his piano playing skills than they did about him as a person, which is really sad when you think about it.
Was it more of a liability, in your opinion, that if it were to come out that he's doing this, it's not only just his piano playing skills, it's a member of our church that's at a higher position that's doing it. It would reflect negatively on on the group as a whole. So let's insulate this. And not that it excuses it by any means, but I don't say you can understand why, but if you're operating from a place of depravity and then not looking out for people, you can understand why that would be the choice they would make. It's not the right one, but if you don't care about the well-being and you're more about image, that's the route someone's going to take. Is this the route that they would take, in your opinion, at that place in time, with other people who maybe didn't have a father that was high up in the ministry who wouldn't look good if this came out? Was this the common practice, in your opinion, when other people would come to church leaders going, "There's a problem here in my family. I'd like help." Is that the MO? Keep it. We're going to control it within here and not let this get out.
Yeah, I agree. I can think of very few instances where I think that they would have actually done the right thing and gotten somebody actually help or reported something to the authorities. The crazy part about all this, the property we lived at was next door to the police department.
Yeah.
It's not like they'd have to go very far.
I'm just going to throw this in there too. I'm wondering, did they have a nice little connection with the police department? Did they have a good relationship there?
I wouldn't say they had a bad relationship, but I would not say that police department would have done nothing if it had been reported either.
Really?
We actually have a very excellent police department in our town.
I wonder, because sometimes you have the cases where it's like, how come nobody locally is looking at this very close? Oh, surprise, that person just bought the new police cruiser for the department. Things of that nature. And I'm curious what kind of connection may have existed there within that dynamic. We're talking today about the Greater Grace World Outreach. Elite Galvin is with us. She hosts the Looking for Grace podcast. And Oscar is also with us. He's a survivor, a former GGWO member. This is part one. There's more to come. Press subscribe wherever you get podcasts as we continue the conversation. In our next part, we're going to be looking at the silence, how Greater Grace turned its own Bible teaching into weapons against anyone who spoke up. Let's dive into that right now. In part one, we laid out what greater grace is, how it takes over every part of your life until leaving basically can mean losing everything. Now, I'm going to talk about the system that it was protecting. The independent investigation found alleged abuse going back decades across countries, with leadership choosing institution over the people every single time. Alita Gavin has tracked these cases for years through her podcast, Looking for Grace. She knows the documented record cold. Oscar sat under the exact teachings that the investigation says were used to keep victims silent. He didn't know that's what they were at the time. Between Alita's research and Oscar's experience, in our second part here, we're going to be diving into how the alleged abuse went unchallenged for so long inside this organization. And this is all an opinion piece and allegations for what they are. Oscar, let's go to you. The investigation pointed to a teaching called the finished works of Christ as one of the most dangerous tools in the organization. It basically meant if you brought up a leader's sin, you were the one with a spiritual problem. You didn't forgive them quick enough. So it's on you. Everybody, these groups have the same sort of structural work in place to keep you coming back for more or not leaving. You sat under that teaching for years. What does it feel like to be told that holding someone accountable for harm makes you the bad guy? How'd you square that up?
Gratefully, I didn't really ever have to deal with that, you know, to the extent that it's being dealt with today with the Grace Report and mm-hmm. the allegations and even the convictions that have occurred, you know, historically with more than one individual. I can speak a little bit to the teaching and the doctrine and how I think that impacted a lot of people within the church in terms of what their attitude might be toward.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, how do you convince somebody who otherwise, I mean, especially someone who, unlike Alita, someone who came in later, who does have a grasp on the outside world, that reporting horrible behavior, sometimes criminal behavior, is somehow wrong? How do they twist that around to make the members think, all right, this is how we're going to operate?
Well, you know, the overarching theme, sort of thrust of greater grace, at least at the time I was in, and you know, this is my observation, opinion, mm-hmm. and I certainly can't speak for the current leadership because sure. I've never, you know, I left before they were empowered. But this notion of the finished work, you know, religion in America is a marketplace, right? And churches need to, men of God, leaders need to differentiate themselves. Whether they do it consciously in the early part of their ministry or not, I can't judge that motive. But Carl really latched onto this finished work grace message. And he did deep, deep dive into the Bible to try to reveal the finished work everywhere in every book of the Bible, all 66 from Genesis through Revelation.
What does it mean? What is the finished work?
Yeah, I'm getting to that. Sorry. What it basically means is that when Christ died on the cross, one of the last things he said before I believe the scripture says
it is finished. Yes,
it is finished, right? But and then he bowed his head and dismissed his spirit, basically. The notion is that he completely finished the work of redeeming all of mankind for all time for sin, and for that reason, if you bring up another person's sin, you are sinning against what Christ did for them.
And so that's the interpretation. If you question anybody who, well, isn't that an interesting way of looking at the world?
I think, you know, they would balance that by saying, you know, you still have to have morality, but believe me, if, and there's so many other people you could bring on, and Alita knows one particular that she just had on her podcast that can tell you how this plays out in in the practical lives of people, particularly in marriages, right? If you've got conflicts between the husband and the wife, and maybe there's some emotional abuse or coercive control going on, you know, the husband toward the wife, they're going to constantly bring up the finished work and say, you need to forgive him. You know, he is hidden in Christ with God. The finished work covers him. He's come to us and confessed his weakness and sin. You know, you need to take him back. So this is an example. And this gets enlarged to include anything. You know, if you were sexually assaulted or abused, you need to let that go, because maybe that abuser or assaulter has fallen on their face before God and asked for forgiveness and received it. And now, you know, you could be guilty of sinning against the finished work by bringing this up.
It's red meat for malignant narcissists, isn't it? Alita, you've talked to survivors across decades of this organization. The investigation found a pattern when people came forward, even parents saying their kids were harmed. Leadership allegedly would minimize it, blame the victim, push forgiveness, and protect the church. I mean, is there a case that hit you harder than others? One where you thought, you know, how did they live with themselves? I mean, obviously, once you kind of get the explanation here, you know, it's red meat for malignant narcissists. It's just like, all right, here's carte blanche to do whatever we want. We just got to say this. What in your research and your experiences has stood out to you of just absolute, complete abominations of Jesus's words that were used to basically justify horrific behavior?
That one is so hard to answer because there's just so many stories, and it's almost almost impossible to compare them. You know what I mean? The one that immediately leaps to mind, though, is actually from the Grace Report itself. Mm-hmm. It was about a young woman who was assaulted by a pastor while they were on a foreign mission field. All of this is bad enough if you're harmed in your home country, where you're at least on your home turf and you hopefully have at least some basic knowledge of the laws or the legal systems or how to find that information if you want to pursue it. But this is a young woman in a foreign country violated by a leader that she had trusted, that she had been taught was her spiritual authority in that situation. She tried reporting it to leaders in Baltimore. The response she got from Carl Stevens was to be asked if she had noticed if her attacker goes away during the night, like, what kind of response is that? So she's assured they'll talk to him. There's no record they actually did. And then they left her there in that foreign country with him still in charge, everyone acting like nothing has happened, which I can't imagine. Like, that's got to be so scary and confusing and heartbreaking. He ends up assaulting her again. And their solution is to bring her back to Baltimore and leave him in charge of the team in the foreign country. And to tell her not to tell anyone, to forgive and forget, like Oscar was saying, in the name of Jesus, the name of the finished work. When he was asked about it by Grace investigators, the current leader, Tom Schaller, actually referenced the story of Joseph in the Bible to try to cast doubt as to whether or not she possibly could have been responsible for her own assault.
The victim.
It's so backward and it's so disgusting. And yet I believe it, because from my own personal experience, I can tell you they care far more about keeping up appearances, which definitely includes keeping leaders or talented individuals in their high profile roles, more than they do about the safety of their congregants or the well-being of their victims.
Is it greed at some point? I mean, does it go beyond someone's philosophy or someone's interpretation of the Bible? Is it so? Is it just kind of the ultimate people that are in power? They don't want to lose it. They don't want to lose their power. They don't want to lose the money that comes along with it and the control that they have. So it's just, we're going to dig in by any means necessary to not have this sort of stuff exposed. What is the thing that is preventing them? What is not inspiring them to come forward and say, this is a problem? You're not okay. You're not allowed to be in our group if you're doing these sort of things. Why from the inside, and it's as it's imploding, why are they saying, yeah, let's keep the people who are placing the bombs around the church in the church, rather than these are not folks that we want in here? They're not cutting the cancer out. They're just like, hey, let's eat more sugar.
Are you talking about from the point of the congregation or the point of the leadership?
From the leadership. Like, again, like, this is just always baffling to me. When you have multiple people, leadership in positions, that hear these horrific stories, what the hell is going on in the meetings that they have about this shit, where they're like, oh, this horrible thing happened? Well, it's hurtful. It's baffling to me. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of those things to hear how multiple people are coming to the same damn crazy conclusion that the predator is not a predator.
I could speak just in general terms of how Carl sort of addressed, you know, the umbrella issue here, and I'm not trying to reference Gotham.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got a different name for the damn umbrella, you know.
But yeah, exactly. But in the case of Greater Grace, you know, Carl used to teach that he would say the gifts and callings of God are without repentance.
Yeah.
Meaning that if you're called to be a pastor, that calling is on you, even if you sin. And then he'd go back and reference David, right? That's the classic, you know, David, you know, had the adulterous affair with Bathsheba and then sent her husband to the front line of the battle so he would get killed, you know, in battling the Philistines or whoever it was they were fighting at the time. And, you know, yet David is called a man after God's own heart. He allegedly wrote all these Psalms and, you know, is a heroic figure in the Old Testament. So, you know, Carl would never in my experience, based on what I observed, he would never go as far as to say that there aren't consequences, but he would say that ultimately the goal should be restoration. And that's what I observe. So I think if you've got a pastor who's willing to go to a foreign mission field, they don't make a lot of money. I mean, it's at the end of the day, even with the pastors in Baltimore, I don't think they're necessarily trying to protect money other than this is the only thing they know how to do.
Yeah.
So they would like to keep that going. None of them are getting rich. Mm-hmm. Well, there is the Dovie Dennis thing, which you probably know about that. Alita knows all about that. She can really fill you in. But the loss of the Linux property and where the money went. But yeah, I wouldn't say that, you know, that they're looking for a way not to hold people accountable. I'm sure in the instance, the story that Alita brought up, that man was taken aside privately and talked to. I hope so. But they're going to err to the side of restoration because he has a calling on his life.
Mm-hmm. How does restoration work when it becomes a pattern and people just keep doing the same stuff over and over? They don't seem to have pattern recognition, do they? It seems to be, everybody just keeps sinning over and over. And especially... I mean, it's one thing when it's their own members, but when it's their own, the own people, your leaders, the person on the mission, the pastor that you were referring to that goes out. I mean, it seems, you know, they may not be monetarily based, but it certainly is control based with a lot of these people.
Absolutely, and I would say Oscar's right. A lot of the lower level pastors, from what I understand, are not paid very well. But some of the upper level pastors, from what I understand, that may be a very different story. Mm-hmm. I think they have a lot to lose. And I think they're restoring the wrong people. They seem to care far more about restoring the predators to keep the image more than they do about restoring the people who have been hurt, which is what, if they're truly a Bible-believing church, that's exactly who they should be restoring.
What the hell does restoration mean to them? Make everybody forget about this so we can just move on and pretend like nothing happened?
Pretty much.
I mean, that's kind of what it feels like. It's not like you're going to rehabilitate, you know, some really horrible type behaviors that seem to have, you know, allegedly been going on in some of these situations. I mean, Oscar, you've had 20 years now outside to think about this. Groups like Greater Grace, they attack science, education, feminism. They say the Bible is the authority and everything. But the investigation found broken families, harmed children, and alleged cover-ups behind all of it. When you sit with that gap between what they preached and what actually happened, I mean, what comes up for you?
Well, I think the best way for me to to state this is to go to one of the core sort of tenets of, you know, what it means to be a greater grace believer over a long period of time. And that is this idea of dying to yourself, right? So, you know, it's a teaching that Jesus had. And I remember listening to an old message from Carl Stevens. I think it might have even gone back to the 70s or 80s. And he was very forceful, and, you know, he was preaching along on this theme. And then he says, until Jesus Christ crucifies your very right to exist. And I don't know if you remember that message, Alita. I think it's one of the hallmarks. It's one of his historical barn burners. So, you know, that's kind of sets up this mentality that you, your natural life, what you do on this earth, your job is not the primary thing. You know, if you have a career, if you're well-educated, and I was fairly well-educated before I went in with a scientific and academic mindset, that has to bow to the pastor's teachings from the Word of God. You know, it's the Bible that is the key to everything that's of any importance. So, because they have all these doctrines, what do they have, like 400 doctrine booklets now, Alita? Something like that.
Oh, they got booklets too.
Oh God, it's an insane number of booklets.
Everybody's got the booklets. Do you get to Xenu at the end? Oh, that's a different one. Yeah.
Well, the thing about the booklets, right, it's a small incremental cost. So
if you've got
volume, right, you can
generate. But wait, there's more. You get a Ronco food dehydrator if you order one right now. Yeah, I mean, God, every damn one of these, if it's the same format. Someone should start a How to Start a Cult for Dummies book, you know, because, I mean, it's the same format. It's like, and selling books and do this and do, I mean, it's stunning. This has been part two. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. There's a third part here as we're talking about Greater Grace World Outreach and the allegations from many over decades against him. Next part, the reckoning, how the silence finally broke, and where the fight for accountability stands right now. That's coming up. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. For decades, people were harmed inside Greater Grace, and many of them were told that their pain was their own fault. Forgiveness meant shutting up. Questioning a leader meant questioning God. Speaking up meant losing everyone that you'd ever known. Then a group of former members called the Millstone sat around a campfire and started telling each other their stories. That led to a years-long investigation, a major series in the Baltimore Banner, and eventually a 172-page independent report that said the church's top leaders need to go. Alita Galvin started her own podcast at work on Greater Grace in 2023 before any of the official investigations launched. She now hosts Looking for Grace, the podcast, and continues tracking the story and talking to survivors. Oscar is also with us as our other guest, joining audio only under that pseudonym. He left over 20 years ago, but when the report came out, he could barely get through it, a report that is now public. Lawsuits have been filed. A former pastor has been indicted. The church recently quit an evangelical financial accountability organization while under review. Wonder what that means. And the leaders, the report said, should still be removed. Still there, allegedly. This is where things seem to stand as of right now. Alita, you started talking publicly about Greater Grace in 23 before the Banner series, before the Grace investigation even existed. When you broke the ice in this, did you have any idea how many people were waiting for someone to go first to share their story of their experiences with Greater Grace?
Honestly, no. And it was really a huge coincidence that at the time, the podcast that I had been a part of happened to launch just months before the Banner articles. And we had no idea that the Millstones were working behind the scenes, that the Banner was working on this. I give a lot of credit to the Millstones because they certainly did years of research before we ever entered the picture. And that series of articles and so much of what happened, even the work with the podcast, a lot of the credit really needs to go to them without their hard work. I really don't think this would have gotten the traction it got. Mm-hmm. At the time, we just came to a point where we realized we couldn't be the only ones that had experienced harm, and realized that maybe if we broke the ice and we told our stories, it might help somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, even if they couldn't say it out loud, maybe they could acknowledge it to themselves, or maybe they would want to talk to us. We had absolutely no idea how right we were, unfortunately. And there's just so many people that I'm so proud of that have either talked behind the scenes, have talked to a friend for the first time, have come on the podcast to talk. It takes so much courage to speak up in any medium when you've been trained to be quiet for so long. I'm just really grateful and proud for everybody that has stood shoulder to shoulder and said, okay, we're done with this, not one more.
Yeah, I mean, there's the investigation, the report is out, anybody can see it. Greater Grace paid for it. I mean, I'll give them that credit, that they had an independent investigation into them, and it came back with some pretty damning results, or some pretty damning findings, I should say. Just making the findings is one thing, and then acting on them, that's a whole other ball of wax. And it seems that there's some question as to, I guess... how well they're responding to the criticism that the report they ordered served up to them. They revoked some lower level ordinations and published a roadmap, but there's some names in the report that were specifically called out. And from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, some are still in place. There's no timeline for when they're going to be removed or not removed or whatever they're going to do. Their financial accountability organization put them under a governance review. The church quit that. Does anything about the response tell you they actually heard what the report said? What's going on after this report says, you got a lot of problems here, here's what you can do to fix them? What have they done?
Little to nothing. I mean, that roadmap was so vague, so incredibly vague. It was like, here, we have all these problems that have occurred in Seeker over decades. Here, we're going to fix it, but we're not really going to tell you how we're going to fix it. We're going to do this internally in the dark. You're just going to have to trust us. Oh, and by the way, the same leaders that they said need to go, they're the ones that are going to solve this. Like, it's completely ridiculous, but I am not surprised in the slightest. The Martin report that Oscar mentioned earlier, the church asked for that one too, and they didn't like the outcome. Mm-hmm. They publicly said the same thing. Publicly, they were like, oh yeah, we're going to fix this. And privately, we're telling their members, yeah, right. Like, these guys are crazy. This is evil. Don't even read this. I'm quite certain there are people that are very, very committed that didn't read that report and refused to read it based on commentary that I saw on social media, which is really unfortunate.
Well, if it's a sin to do so, they villainize reading material that's going to, might cast some shade, even if it's true. I mean, that's, that's an interesting way of keeping people in your grasp on something like this. I have no idea. But I know I can say from just looking at patterns of other systems that have been a religious organization where you have some folks that are doing some shady stuff, and it's like, oh, well, we're going to remove you. I'm not saying this is happening here. I have no idea. But typically what happens is those shady folks who've done some shady things that are called for removal says, oh, you want to remove us from your shady organization that we've been a shady part of for a long time? Well, we're going to talk about your shady things that you've been doing too, if you're going to get rid of us. And then suddenly everybody stays in place and everybody's going to fix the problems together. It never really works out that way. But I would venture to guess maybe some of those dynamics might be at play, in my opinion here.
It wouldn't surprise me, to be completely honest. Some of these people, particularly the top three in leadership, have been in their positions for over 20 years, which when you think of a board of an organization, that's an awfully long time to be in that position. At that point, getting rid of them is going to be next to impossible. And even if they do, I don't think that they're going to fire them. I think that they'll probably throw them a nice big retirement party and give them a pat on their way out the door. I don't think that they're going to make this about any wrongdoing at all. I think they're going to do this as gracefully as possible and as wonderfully as possible for that guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's give us kind of a better idea here of What are some of the widespread issues here within this church specifically? I mean, we don't need to go into every single detail. It'd be impossible. But like, I'm assuming there's a lot of allegations here that are pretty dark against a lot of people. You've already listed one on that mission trip and what was going on there. I mean, is that kind of the culture, if in your opinion, as you would describe it across this thing, that's running unchecked?
There's so much. I had a really good conversation with the investigators myself. And one of the things that I'm concerned with above and beyond the sexual abuse, which I will never minimize that it's horrific.
Yeah.
Is the domestic abuse. I mean, certainly that was the case in my situation. And yeah. I have been made aware of quite a bit of that. And that to me seems to be almost more rampant than what's going on with the sexual abuse and likely feeds into the sexual abuse because unfortunately, you have kids growing up in these environments where they think that this behavior is okay. Yeah. And you have young men in particular who are seeing other men in these positions get away with these things like it's no big deal. So what's going to stop them from behaving that way? Nothing.
Yeah. It creates a hive of predatory individuals. Oscar, you know, you obviously you've been out of it for 20 years. You described reading some of the Grace Report as physically sickening, you know, only a few minutes at a time before you had to stop. Tell me, I mean, what to you? I mean, why is it physically sickening? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I knew that that it was planned, you know, to come out. Probably around last summer, they announced that, you know, they had initiated it. I had followed the Baltimore Banner articles and on the first series of podcasts that Alita did in 2 years ago, you know, when all of this came to light in the spring and summer of 2024. And I sort of at first thought, well, when it dropped, I'm just not going to read it because I was already disgusted and I've carried this trauma, this burden of just feeling betrayed by the whole outfit really since 2004, since I left, because they had a scandal back then that resulted in a split of the church and this IAGM and the Sandy Cove meetings. And that's all on the internet. I never attended any of that, but so, I was already very disgusted with the historical treatment of, you know, scandals around anything sexual, even if it was between consenting adults, and how it affected the ministry. I certainly didn't want to read anything about children or young people knowing from the Baltimore Banner article some of what went on. Yeah. But after a couple of days, I did decide to download it. I had a few texts back and forth with Alita. I remember reading the first section and realizing who some of the perpetrators were that were not named, you know, in the initial Baltimore Banner articles, and just the gravity and of what they had done, and how could anyone hide in this finished work of Christ teaching and be a pastor, you know, an associate pastor running a affiliate church and grooming a teenage girl, for example, or on the mission field and SA-ing a girl, a young woman, not a girl, a woman in her 20s who was a faithful missionary. How could you do that? I mean, how could these teachings be real? How could they have any substance to them in terms of transforming people's lives? You know, not in terms of the mask they wear publicly when, you know, they're in front of other Greater Grace people, but in terms of who they really are. And go ahead.
Is that why they still maintain membership? I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand that part of it. I'm always baffled by this in every organization.
I'll tell you what I think it is. I think it's the sunken cost fallacy. I think people have so many years, in some cases, or decades invested in this thing. They don't know where the hell else to go.
You bought enough workbooks, and now it's like, shit, I still haven't met Xenu yet. You know, but... But I'm almost there. I mean, then
there was the teaching of eternal rewards that, you know, Stevens made a lot of emphasis that, you know, this church was going to get all these rewards in heaven that, you know, because of going into all the world and teaching this finished work message. And it's like a holy Amway. You
know? It is. That's a great way of describing it. It is a holy Amway. They all are. They are all holy Amways. I mean, it really, we just give them some pink Cadillacs so they could do some, Mary Kay at the same time. You know, might as well two for one. Then you hit both ends, cleaning products and beauty supplies and eternal salvation all in one. You just can't talk about any how shady anybody is. I'm going to throw this one to Ichi. I mean, I'll start with you, Oscar, since you were just talking. If someone's listening right now, sees themselves in what you've described, still inside something like this, whether it be Greater Grace or out there in another one and carrying and holding on to this, what would your message be to them?
I would say, trust yourself, what you're feeling, what you're sensing, even if you can't put words to it. And no matter how hard it is at first, and it probably will be, start setting boundaries. You know, if there's a demand on your time and life and energy or money or whatever, or even ability to forgive that you can't realistically, comfortably meet, say no. Learn to say no. And if you're in a toxic environment and you're feeling it, then you have a hard decision to make. And that decision is, what is the cost of staying versus the cost of going? In a lot of cases, you may, if you work for an employer who's part of the church, you may lose your job if you go. You may lose your family. Yeah. Your spouse may leave you. She or he may choose to stay with the kids, with the church, and fight you in court. Things have happened.
Yeah, it's religious coercive control. When you control so many elements of someone's life, it makes it a hell of a lot more difficult for them to leave. And I think boundaries is a key thing there. Especially, I think that's a very true statement for so many people that find themselves caught up in something like this who weren't born into it. They may have walked in and may have at that moment in time, and I'm curious if you would say this too, were you not great at setting boundaries, not just necessarily within your religious life and your spiritual life, but just in general with people as a whole, when you found yourself, you know, finding Greater Grace to be something positive in your life initially, were boundaries not your strong suit at that moment?
No, boundaries have not been my strong suit until I got into psychotherapy. Yep. Years later.
And that's what they prey on, is that.
Right. And I'm from a broken family myself that had no boundaries.
Sure. And especially, and then Elita, I'm going to guess you were brought up not even probably knowing what they were, because it's just, it's absolute. There is no boundaries. It's you're going to do what you're supposed to do. Same question to you, someone listening right now who may be hearing this, finding themselves going, oh, I feel like it's a sin listening to this. But also, feeling like, I can kind of relate. What would you say?
I want to echo what Oscar said. But I also want to point out that, yes, it is overwhelming to think about the things that you could lose if you were to think about walking out the door. But I also want people to know that when you do, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of us out here who have wrestled with those same questions, who have dealt with those same emotions, and who very much care about the people that are still there. That's why we do what we do. We don't hate anybody that's in there. We don't hate you guys. We actually care very deeply. We want you to be well. And if that means staying and fixing it for you, good luck. Sorry to say that, but good luck. But for many, to be well, it's going to mean you're going to have to exit. But I want you to know that on the other side of that exit, there is joy and happiness. Bad things may happen to you, but it's not going to happen because you left. There was teaching that, like, you could get cancer of the throat, that you could get hit by a car, these terrible things that could happen to you. That's not true. That's not true. Bad things happen in life, but it's not happening because you walked out the door of Greater Grace.
God.
And there are so many people out here that do care and are willing to be there for you.
It is baffling. It is baffling that, I mean, it's such a childish way of thinking too, of just bad things will happen to you. We hear it with IBLP. We hear it with other ones too. It's like, ooh, and it's this fear of the unknown. And ultimately, that's what this all ends up being, is the fear of the unknown. And since you don't know it, we're going to claim we know it. And if you question what we know, well, then you're questioning God. There you go. The recipe to start a cult. Geez. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and giving us your insight into your experiences and your opinions with Greater Grace World Outreach. Obviously, these have been everybody's opinions, allegedly, and everything else that throws into there. You can do your own research on the group, that project, or that 170-some page research into what's been going on with them is also out online if anybody wants to read what their findings are. And then compare it with what the action plan is to fix some of these things and do your own, make your own judgment. But just hearing you guys give us your stories today was powerful. Thank you very much. Again, your thoughts on our website or on our Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.